Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Thank you for joining us today and welcome. This is an hour dedicated to understanding a little more about ourselves, our beliefs, and how we approach enlightenment. Indeed, an hour devoted to learning something more, not just about the world we live in, but about how, what, and why we think as we do. An hour for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we believe and who we have become. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and my partner, Ravinder, awaits you there now. You can log on by going to eldontaylor.com/chat. That's eldontaylor.com/chat. So, Ravinder, say hello to everyone. Tell us about your chat room, and please share your good thoughts for the day.
Well, hello, everyone. Yes, of course, you're always invited to the wonderful chat room. That is eldontaylor.com/chat, where the chat is always exciting, stimulating, and very, very enlightening. And it's a fabulous day here. In fact, life is fabulous. I hope you're all having a fabulous day, too. Come say hi to me.
It's a fabulous, fabulous day. All right. Now, every week I read some of your letters as our way of paying respect to the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week, our show was all about dreams, and our guest, Dr. Jillian Holloway, took your calls. Evelyn wrote, "Jillian Holloway is a master of dream interpretation. What a fabulous show." Brian remarked, "The Jillian Holloway show was lots of fun. Thanks for the opening. Thanks for opening the second half of the show to the callers and chat room. The chat room was on super scroll mode. I had to back up the scroll several times to keep up with the threads of conversation." Well, now there's a plug for your chat room, Rav. You like that?
Always, always. It's a great chat room.
Joshua wrote, "Great show, great information. I love Provocative Enlightenment Radio." Now, that's what we like to hear. Thanks, Joshua. Celeste wrote, "I just finished your book, I Believe. Thank you for it. I shall keep it in my library for as long as I live to remind me to read it from time to time and remind me that what I believe matters. Thanks again. Love your CD. I have played it a lot. And even if we haven't had much sunshine here in Vancouver, British Columbia, I have felt very energetic. Your CD brings sunshine to our lives. Thanks again." Well, thank you, Celeste, for your feedback, and for all of you out there. If you've not obtained your copy of I Believe, When What You Believe Matters, it's back in stock and on sale at both Amazon and Barnes & Noble. The book comes with a bonus free Intertalk CD, the one that Celeste is commenting on in her letter. And Jenny wrote, "Love you, Eldon Taylor. Thanks for all your great work, still using all the great stuff we purchased from your company, especially the Respect and Manners CD for my munchkin. Anytime she acts up, I put it on at night, and the next day there is a huge difference. What a blessing your work is." Well, thank you, Jenny. We truly do appreciate your feedback and love your stories. Isn't that right, Rav?
Yes, we do, and I certainly think your work is a blessing, too. Totally invaluable to me. I use it constantly, all the time. So you are a blessing to me personally, way beyond our relationship.
Oh, well, I appreciate that, but yeah, okay, anyhow, all right.
And I'm not just biased.
Well, you are biased, and that took me by off guard, so we'll just leave it there. All right, that's all the time we're going to take for letters today, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to eldon@eldontaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming, and once again, I thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now to today's show. The real men in black, pyramids and the Pentagon, top secret places, NASA conspiracies. Now, every one of these subjects is actually the title to a book by the same author. So you might ask, is this guy for real? I mean, are there really men in black as in the famous motion picture? And do they really lock down aliens? And what does the Pentagon have to do with pyramids? And wait, what about NASA and top secret places? Is this all some Area 51 nonsense, some concocted story designed to peddle more conspiracy theories and feed public paranoia about their government and otherwise supplicate those crazy folks that claim to have been abducted by aliens? You know, it's very easy to dismiss information that is out of the norm, and even more so when it can be laughed at. Remember, as I've told you all before, and as my book programming points out again and again, by those with whom their agenda conflicts. You can add this to the mix as well. If something can be made to appear to be fiction or ludicrous, then the objective, dismiss the information as so much hogwash and nonsense, is almost certainly achieved. Indeed, make a fiction comedy movie out of the truth and no one will believe the truth is possible. The truth is compromised. But what is the truth? So which is it? Are there real men in black? Has the idea been so portrayed that no one will believe it? And has this been done as a countermeasure to destroy the credibility behind any information out there that may suggest otherwise? Well, our guest today has answers to all of this and more. He is an expert when it comes to the borderlands of secrecy, government cover-ups involving aliens, and all sorts of monsters. Nick Redfern works full-time as an author, lecturer, and journalist. He writes about a wide range of unsolved mysteries, including Bigfoot, UFOs, the Loch Ness Monster, alien encounters, and government conspiracies. He writes for UFO Magazine, Fate, Fortean Times. His books include Keep Out, The Real Men in Black, The NASA Conspiracies, Contactees, and Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, and his newest, The Pyramids and the Pentagon. Nick has appeared on numerous television shows, including Legend Hunters, BBC's Out of This World, History Channel's Ancient Aliens, Monster Quest, America's Book of Secrets and UFO Hunters, National Geographic Channel's The Truth About UFO and Paranatural, Countdown with Keith Olbermann, and Sci-Fi Channel's Proof Positive. Now, I don't know what kind of Countdown with Keith Olbermann, how that ties in, but I'll probably ask. So let's get the man in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Mr. Nick Redfern.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
It's good to have you here, sir. I have to ask you right from the get-go. Let's begin with a simple question. What on earth ever propelled you to pursue this chase for monsters, aliens, secrets, and so forth?
Well, you know, I think people get involved and interested in these sort of things by one of two ways. One, they either have some sort of profound experience of their own, or they know someone who has. Now, you know, I've never seen a UFO. You know, I've never had an alien abduction or anything like that. You know, I've never photographed the Loch Ness Monster. But the reason I got involved and interested is that my dad was in the British Royal Air Force. He worked on radar, and he was involved in several UFO incidents where the guys running the radar screens tracked unknowns, you know, UFOs, for want of a better mm-hmm. term, flying across the North Sea, approaching the English coastline, which is on the east coast of England. And the first thought, because this was still the height of the Cold War, it was like, well, it's got to be the Russians. But the speed and the maneuvers that these UFOs were performing, it was clearly not the Russians. And so aircraft fighter planes were scrambled to try and intercept whatever these things were. And the pilots reported how these objects, they were sort of brightly lit objects, but they couldn't make any sort of shape out because they were just so bright. Kind of played like a game of cat and mouse with them and flew rings around the aircraft until the aircraft literally had to return to base because they were running low on fuel. And this occurred over the course of several nights, and at the end of it, everybody was told, you know, you won't talk about this, you've signed the government secrecy oath, etc. And my dad didn't tell me until I was about 13, something like that. And then when he did tell me, it got me interested, because not just because it was my own dad, but because also he was someone who had a background in the military. You know, he worked on radar, mm-hmm. so he was able to differentiate between, you know, sometimes the normal mistakes that do turn up on radar. For example, a lot of people don't realize that something like a flock of birds tightly packed together can actually be picked up on a radar scope because, you know, it's so densely packed. And so that got me interested in the subject. Now, when I left school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had no idea at all. But I found that there was a job advertised local, which was a magazine, and it was all based around for teenagers at the time, and it was sort of music, fashion, entertainment, etc. And I thought, well, that sounds kind of fun and interesting, and didn't sound like a real job, you know. So I thought I'd apply for it, and I got the job, and I spent 2 years working there, basically being sort of taught all the ins and outs of journalism. And then after a while, you know, when that dried up, I went back to sort of regular jobs for a while. But then I thought, you know, well, I enjoyed working on that. I enjoyed doing the writing and learning about journalism. And I got this interest in the paranormal. What would happen if I had a go at trying to combine the two? And so that's what sort of kicked me off in this, was the case involving my dad and getting on board with this magazine and learning journalism and then thinking of a way to combine the two and, you know, and make a job out of it. But equally, be passionate about it as well, you know, because otherwise it just becomes like any other job. You know, you want to have some fulfillment out of it. So as long as, you know, I enjoy it and I'm excited about it and energized by it, you know, I'll keep doing it.
Okay, so let me follow this a little bit. Now, your father tells you about it. Mm-hmm. So then you become, you know, through serendipity, design, whatever, a correspondent of sorts, an investigative reporter, a journalist. And you've written many, many books and investigated many, many different paranormal, if you will, or paranatural kinds of things. The obvious next question that I have to ask you comes from the setup piece then. Are there truly men in black? And if so, who are they?
Well, there actually are. I mean, a lot of people assume, quite incorrectly actually, that, you know, that the men in black were created in 1997 for the Hollywood movie starring Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. A lot of people don't realize that the movie, or the movies now, were actually based on a comic book series of the same name. And the comic books were inspired by real-life reports. I mean, the term Men in Black actually goes back to 1953. It was coined by a man named Gray Barker. And in 1956, Barker wrote a book called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. And this was the first published book on the Men in Black mystery. You know, so it's actually a very old mystery. But the problem, of course, is that unless you're into UFOs, which is a small number of people, until the movies came out, nobody had ever heard of them. So they assumed there was no mention of them before that time, not realizing, you know, that dozens of books have been written about the subject from 56 right up until the, you know, the time of the movies, and since then at least another 7 or 8. But basically there are a lot of reports, literally into the hundreds now, high hundreds, where people have had sort of like profound UFO encounters and experiences. And then, say, within 24, 48 hours of the encounter, there's been this sort of ominous bang on the front door. And when they've opened it, there have been these guys stood there in black suits, black hats, sunglasses, who basically, you know, reel off this warning about not to talk about your UFO encounter. Now, I actually think that the whole image of the men in black, the black suits, the hats, the sunglasses, and this sort of unemotional approach is kind of like an act. In many respects, you know, it's done for two reasons. One, to intimidate and frighten the witness. And number two, if anybody talks about it, you're going to think that the person's crazy, you know. And in, certainly in today's world, people are going to say, well, you've watched too many Men in Black movies, you know.
Right.
So in other words, using that Men in Black motif and image acts as a good cover, because the average person won't take it seriously if you have that experience and tell anyone. You know, it's far better to appear like that than turn up in a military uniform and say, hi, you know, I'm Colonel so-and-so from the nearest Air Force base. People would believe that.
Now, you know, one of the areas that I spend a great deal of time on is all this, I think of it as mind programming, but you can just think of it as how we are sold, what it is that we're going to believe, what it is that we're going to base our value anchors on. And one, you know, a stated objective, as I said in the setup piece, a stated technique for countering information that goes against the norm is this notion of a belly laugh. You know, if we can just discredit it, we don't have to deal with its factual nature. We don't have to pursue it with logic. Now, I wasn't aware that Men in Black had a series of cartoons or comic books going back as far. Do you think, perhaps you can only base this on your opinion and your expertise based on experience, do you think that the comic books were created to discredit the idea that there was indeed really Men in Black?
No, I don't. I think I don't think that's the case with the movies. I think somebody in Hollywood or in the comic book world realized that, you know, this is an interesting area and it would be a marketable and sellable movie and comic book. So why don't we write about it? You know, I don't dispute that government agencies have on occasion tried to poke fun and, you know, make these subjects lose credibility. But no, I think this is, you know, this is the way Hollywood works. You know, they look around for good ideas that they think are going to make an exciting film or comic book, and then they do it, you know.
And they found it there. All right, then tell me this. Are there women in black?
Yes, there are, actually. I've got an entire chapter on the women in black in the real Men in Black book that I wrote. And
right.
The reports aren't as many, or as I stress in the book, I'm not sure if there aren't as many reports, but maybe because the Men in Black motif is so recognized, perhaps people don't realize when they actually have an encounter with a woman in black. But they're usually described as identical, you know, in terms of that they're wearing like a black business outfit, sunglasses, unsmiling, very unemotional. And, you know, there are occasions where they've turned up instead of the Men in Black. So, you know, it's not as just sort of a straightforward phenomenon as some people think. You know, you have this other aspect to it as well.
Okay, now the movie portrays that, you know, the men in black are, you know, humans.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of discussion about the men in black as not necessarily being human. They may be an alien dressed as a man in black with, plastic skin or something. Tell us about that.
Well, this is where it gets into sort of really weird areas because you're right, you know, in the films, you know, the men in black, they look like government agents. You know, that's how, you know, they look like they could take you on in a fight and probably could, you know. But if you go back and read the books, the real life stories, the men in black are actually nothing like that at all. Most of them are described as only being like 5 feet to 5 feet five tall, very skinny, almost looking sort of emaciated or anorexic. You know, they've got skin the color of somebody with anemia. And, you know, they look like they weigh about 100 pounds. And so, you know, they're nothing like the MIB in the films at all. You know, not just the way they act or whether they're supposed to be from the government, but even the way they look. And, of course, because they have this very strange look to them, and actually several people in varying ways have described them in the same way. Number one is being very creepy. That's a word that several have used. And also, one described them as having the sort of look on his face that a dog has when it's about to bite you, you know, and you back away when the dog's eyes go wide or whatever. And most people have this sort of very unsettling vibe, if you like, from the Men in Black, which has led to theories that, you know, could they be some sort of alien entity themselves? Other people go down the path, you know, that there's some sort of paranormal or even demonic type creature. You know, some people look at the idea that, you know, they're almost like vampires upgraded for the modern era, you know, sort of pasty white, usually only come out at night and dressed in black. You know, it's like, is it just a modern incarnation of very old occult visitation, you know, where somebody would be visited by the devil, say, in the 15th century, and he would turn up on a black horse with a black cloak? Now they turn up in black cars and black suits, but they look equally creepy and almost, you know, occult-driven in some respect.
Right. You know, I have to ask you this. Do you think, then, that our men in black, women in black, are connected with governments in the world? Or do you think it's possible that these are just, you know, aliens carrying out their own methods of keeping the information quiet?
Well, I think it's why it gets confusing is because I think there's at least two things going on. There are these sort of weirder creepier men in black going around silencing people. And there are actually government documents where the FBI and the Air Force in the 50s and 60s were trying to track these people down. So in other words, you know, everybody thinks the men in black are from the government. Then you read these government files where the agencies are asking each other, do you know who the men in black are? You know, so on the one hand, we have this one category of men in black, which are really weird and creepy, that the government seems to know exists, but they're not sure who they are or even what they are. But at some point, I think it was like the penny dropped within the government, and they realized, well, hang on a minute, we can actually exploit this mystery for our own ends by impersonating the men in black if we want to silence people and threaten them and intimidate them. And, you know, we can just pass it off as the men in black. No one will ever know it was Colonel so-and-so from this base or that base, just put on a black suit for effect. So I think that's what's going on, that there's a real very strange phenomenon. And then that same phenomenon has been exploited and used by the military to cover their tracks as well.
I must ask you about the NASA conspiracies before we get to your newest book, Pyramids in the Pentagon. And I want to spend a great deal of time focusing on pyramids in the Pentagon. So at the same time, I don't want to do any injustice to your book, The NASA Conspiracies, because it's a great read. But in short, can you share with us perhaps a couple of NASA cover-ups?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, one of the things that's particularly interesting to me is the whole issue of crashed UFO stories, you know, like the Roswell story. And the reason I find these stories particularly intriguing and important is because, you know, it's like if we're looking for proof of the existence of UFOs, well, if one crashes and, you know, somebody gets there before the military, then the cover-up and the secrecy is over because, you know, if you find bodies, you find wreckage, that's going to prove the existence of the phenomenon, right, you know, in a millisecond. And one of the cases I talk about in the book, which was kind of like a Roswell-type UFO crash story, originated in Bolivia in May 1978 when some sort of egg-shaped object came down on a mountainside in Bolivia in the jungles. And a number of files have now officially surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act on this particular case from the CIA, the Air Force, and NASA, all talking about all of them wanting to know what this thing was. Was it a satellite? You know, was it like a Russian spy satellite? Was it part of a rocket? Was it something else? Was it even a UFO? And the UFO theory was actually taken very seriously. And NASA even sent personnel down there to investigate it. But what's interesting is that the NASA files actually sort of come to a grinding halt with the story that we're sending our guys down to see what it is. And then suddenly the paperwork rather conveniently vanishes at that point, or it can't be found, or they claim that, you know, no more paperwork was put together, etc. So, you know, we find this a lot where, you know, agencies will go out and investigate things. And just when it gets to the good points, oh, we decided to stop the investigation, or 30 years later, we can't find the files or whatever, you know. And this was a classic example of how NASA were involved in this crash of whatever this weird 15-foot or so egg-shaped object was. We know they sent people down. They had people going down there with cameras and movie cameras, all sorts of things. And but, you know, that material evidence has just not surfaced. And so that's sort of a classic you know, example of the way in which a lot of information goes into these agencies, but not a great deal comes out the other side.
Right. It's a great book. I'm probably going to ask you yet another question on it when we get to the next half hour, but our chat room's also busy with questions. We have a hard break here in just about 50 seconds. So we're speaking with Mr. Nick Redfern about several of his books, including Men in Black and Pyramids, and the book Pyramids and the Pentagon. I'll get that said correctly. You can check out his work at his website, and I encourage you to do that. It's Nick Redfern's Books. That's Redfern's is plural, N-I-C-K-R-E-D-F-E-R-N-S, books.blogspot.com. If you're not already in our chat room, get there now. We've got a great film to show you of humans who claim that they've worked alongside aliens in government projects. Just go to eldentaylor.com/chat. Stay tuned. You don't want to miss what's coming up after these words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Nick Redfern about all things secret, from the real men in black to the NASA conspiracies. But before we get back to today's show, I want to remind you to like our Facebook fan page for Provocative Enlightenment Radio. As a fan, you'll always know where we are and what's on next. I'd also like to invite you to join me on Facebook while you're there. All right. Before the break, Nick, you had just told us or just shared with us an example of a NASA conspiracy. Your book, NASA Conspiracies, is a great read, and I don't want to do it any slide at all. So I'm going to ask you one more thing about that book before we go on. Tell us about the cover-up with respect to the face on Mars.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a sort of a very weird story, you know, this huge sphinx-like face that stares up from the face of Mars, an area called Cydonia. And NASA actually doesn't avoid talking about the face on Mars. They actually have a page on it at their official website. But their public view, at least, is that it's just a case like the equivalent of people seeing faces in clouds. You know, they take the view that that when the light and the shadows are in the right place and the sun's in the right place overhead, etc., it sort of casts everything in a way that it makes it look like a face. And because we recognize faces, that's what we perceive it as. However, the more we look into it, we find a lot of intriguing things going along as well. One being that in the area of Cydonia where this sphinx-like face is, there are also a number of formations or creations that look eerily like Egyptian pyramids. And so this has inevitably given rise to the idea, could this have been evidence of some very ancient Martian civilization that, you know, obviously became extinct at some point in the, who knows how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of years ago, and could they have come to the Earth and possibly even influenced our cultures, our ancient cultures, with their own style of architecture, etc. You know, the stories of these fantastic beings coming down from the sky and teaching the human race, that kind of thing. And the more you look into it, we actually find evidence that there may have been people in government who knew about the face on Mars long before it was officially found, if you like, in 1976. There have sort of been a few allusions and references to faces on Mars in sci-fi novels over the years, but where the authors actually had close friends and colleagues who worked within the world of official secrecy, as if possibly somebody on the inside wanted to get the story out about the face on Mars, and they did so first. They tested the waters by having the story promoted in science fiction novels to see how people would react to the idea. Then possibly, you know, we'll release a bit more and a bit more. So, you know, it's not as sort of clear-cut that it's just a bunch of rock and, you know, when the shadows are in the right place, etc. There's far more going on than that.
All right. Now, you know, one book that we haven't touched on before we get is your book, Keep Out. And I basically, you know, I pulled out four books here. I tell you, we could take 4 hours for sure. looking at these books, but I want to just kind of highlight this one. We all know that there are many top secret areas, but, you know, and indeed, one of my former employees was married to a pilot based in Las Vegas, and he told me that even he was not allowed to fly over Area 51. But in your book, Keep Out, where you cover these kinds of off-limit areas, including underground facilities, etc., you have a most provocative chapter titled Anthrax, Aliens, and Assassinations. Please flesh this one out some for us. What on earth is that chapter all about?
Well, basically, that's a very weird story, and it deals with a number of people in the field of microbiology, which is basically the study of things like exotic and lethal viruses, who were a number of them working at highly classified installations all around the world. And the book itself is like a worldwide study of secret installations. But many of these microbiologists, particularly between 2001 and 2005, they were dropping dead like flies. Suicide, murder, car accidents, jumping off bridges, just bizarre deaths. And rumors started to fly around that, you know, these people had actually been targeted for, you know, for death. but nobody sort of really knew who, by, or why. But many of them were all researching anthrax, which, of course, you know, is one of the things that, you know, strikes terror into a lot of people, quite understandably. You know, nobody wants an anthrax outbreak. But a lot of these scientists were researching biological warfare, bacteriological warfare, anthrax, etc. And as I said, they were dropping like flies left, right, and center. And, you know, if you type into Google, like, you know, microbiologist deaths, you find whole lists of them who just died in such bizarre ways. And so that chapter is like a study of these people, where they worked, and the theories that, you know, have been presented as to whether or not there were sort of like shadowy terrorist groups that were trying to wipe them out, because they were actually trying to find cures to,
what do you think, Nick? What do you think is the real story there?
Well, I do truly believe that there was some sort of shadowy organization that was trying to wipe these scientists out, and they were very skilled to where they made some of these deaths look like accidents or suicide. You know, there were a couple of cases where somebody had actually slashed their wrists, and they'd slashed both wrists. And what it was, it actually showed that, you know, when the forensic analysis was done, the cuts were so deep, say, for example, on the left hand, that there afterwards, the left hand just wouldn't have had the power to inflict the same sort of deep cuts on the right hand, because it would have severed nerves and tendons and all sorts. And yet, that's what we saw. So I think...
Why would they be eliminated, Nick? Why would they be eliminated?
Well, because a lot of them, you know, they were Western scientists who were looking to find cures in the event that there was some sort of catastrophic biological outbreak. So in other words, if you're going to kill people and you're the enemy, you're going to kill the ones who are going to be able to find the antidote and the cure. And that's what a lot of these scientists were working on. They weren't working on offensive, you know, biological warfare programs. They were working on defensive programs to find cures and antidotes in the event of an attack. So if you're the attacking force, they're the ones you're going to want to terminate, I guess.
All right, let's move on. I was struck by the similarity between your next book and the pyramids and the Pentagon. I guess that's your newest book, isn't it?
Yes.
And the Indiana Jones storyline, some of the information in your new book, just seems to follow along with that storyline. So please tell us what the book is about.
Sure. Well, Pyramids of the Pentagon is basically a study primarily using the Freedom of Information Act of government files and investigations into the mysteries of the past. You know, we all know that the government over the years has investigated things like UFOs and psychic phenomena like remote viewing, that sort of thing. A lot of people, if not most people, didn't realize that, you know, they had little think tank type groups that investigated the mysteries of the past, like stories of ancient astronauts, Atlantis, Noah's Ark, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Ark of the Covenant. They had sort of, again, like Indiana-type, Jones-type groups that, you know, their entire working day was taken up in digging into the mysteries of the past. And it's clear, you know, to further our knowledge of archaeology or history, etc. You know, that's the work of archaeologists, historians, theologians, you know, etc. Mm-hmm. What they were looking at was, I guess, not so much evidence, but data that suggested to them or made them suspicious of the possibility that in the ancient past, ancient man had knowledge of technologies that we've either lost or forgotten today, far in advance of some of our own. And they were looking into the past to see if they could uncover and tap into some of those technologies and kind of weaponize the past in the present. You know, if there was sort of a highly advanced technologies in the hands of ancient man, could they be understood today, and could they be, you know, transferred into the form of a weapon, which is unfortunate, but that's, you know, that's what governments are in the business of doing, you know, is finding better ways to create better weapons. And so that was one of their primary goals, and also to try and understand the truth behind the whole ancient astronauts mystery. You know, were we visited in the ancient past, and were some of these visitations, if they were real, you know, did they prompt mythologies, folklore, stories of, you know, religious events, that were actually alien events. You know, they weren't biased one way or the other. They were just interested in knowing where the truth lay, so to speak.
Okay, now I guess where I am right now is, does the right hand know what the left hand's doing? Because if we have an operation within the U.S. government, a secret operation that deals with aliens and knowledge of those aliens, because we have maybe wreckage in Roswell or Area 51, and yet then we have another operation within the government investigating whether or not there were UFOs in ancient history and doing so objective. I mean, how could they be objective if indeed we had solid evidence today that there were aliens traveling here? I'm kind of confused there. Clear that up for me, will you?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it actually can be clarified actually quite easily. It comes down to one thing, that government agencies are often very reluctant to share data with each other. And even within the agencies, you know, you're only cleared to know what you need to know. You know, it's not like, say, for example, you know, let's say for tomorrow you got offered a job working at the CIA and your job was interpreting spy satellite photographs taken high above Iran, you know, and it's your job to try and determine what the photographs show. You know, do they show missiles? Do they show tanks? Whatever. Well, you know, just because that's your job in the CIA, when you get that job, you're not automatically told what happened at Roswell. Because it, you know, it had no bearing on your job. So, in other words, that's how government agencies, not just in the U.S., but all across the entire world, that's how secrets are kept. That, you know, you only tell the people who need to know. So, you know, let's say, for example, the Army is looking into, you know, an issue concerning the pyramids, and the Air Force may have done a similar investigation, but for reasons of their own making, they don't want to share that information. You know, the mere fact that the Army project is spending $5 million is neither here nor there. They're not going to inform the Army that, hey, we looked into it and this is what we found. If they have a reason, you know, it might be an obscure reason, it may not be, but if they have a reason for not sharing their data with another agency, then they don't. You know, that's how it works.
Yeah, and we have an unfortunate, well, that is unfortunate. I'll just leave it at that. There is a very relevant question that a caller has, so let's go to the phones for a second and take a phone call out of Portland, Oregon. Linda's on the line, and she has a very relevant question to what it is that we're addressing right this minute. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Linda. You have a question.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Hello?
Linda, you're on the air. You have a question for Nick?
Yes, I do have a question. Okay, and again, this is really fascinating because I'm hearing more and more reasons why perhaps there's a cover-up. I'm talking about what biological warfare, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, it seems like the whole question of this UFO situation certainly would be a lot easier if the government would share. It sounds like they do a lot of research. But, again, I guess one of my questions is, and what I've heard a lot, is if this information came out, it would just shake our foundations because, you know, we're based in a lot of, you know, Christian beliefs, and it just might shake up our world. Is that a factor adding to why there's such a cover-up?
Well, I think, Linda, that, you know, that certainly that theory has been addressed. You know, the extent to which it would actually have an impact, you know, is obviously open to question. We don't know until the day it happens, if it happens. But what I would say is I know that theory has been addressed, you know, would it shake our foundation? And I think what the government has done, it's taken the safest approach, which is to say nothing. It doesn't necessarily mean the government is 100% sure it would shake foundations and change society overnight. But if they can't, if there's even a sense that it could do that, you know, that's what they invariably do. They just say, okay, we're just not going to say anything. It's just not worth the risk. So, and I think that's what's happened. And I think there's also the fact that sometimes, you know, we often give governments too much credit as to what they know. You know, it may be the case that the government has a lot of data and information and even UFO wreckage hidden away, but that doesn't necessarily tell you a great deal about the origins of the phenomenon or what they want or where they're from, etc. So it might be that the government just has more data than the rest of us and doesn't know what to do with it. You know, that it's such of a big problem to them that they just prefer to hide it away. But even they might not, you know, really have all the answers.
And again, would that information create like hysteria or?
Well, you know, I mean, it could do. I mean, I don't think it would so much cause hysteria. I think a lot of it would cause anger because you quite rightly pointed out, you know, America's a very Christian nation. And if whichever president was in power at the time, if he or she said, you know, something along the lines of, well, we've decided to complain about UFOs and they're actually responsible for all the world's major religions, you know, and that religion is just a distorted view of alien visitation.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen is that that president would probably never, ever get elected again. That party, you know, whether Democrats or Republicans, would probably not get in again for decades because the other side would use the ammunition of, you know, they're destroying the foundations of Christianity in America. Everybody would agree with them, and they would just be booted straight out, you know. So, again, I think all of this comes also down to politics, that no, if it's true or even if it's suspected, you know, I don't know, but if it's suspected even, nobody is going to, in government, in power, is going to want to reveal this because it will have impact on them so badly as well, because it will provoke such outrage that people, whether it is true or not, people just won't want to believe it. And then they'll deny it. And when they deny it, they get angry, you know, that people are bringing it up. So.
Thanks for your call, Linda. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let me ask you this, Nick. Do you know anything about President Jimmy Carter, who promised that he would, you know, make all of this information available to the public and then later was denied or claimed that he was denied access to it? He couldn't make it public.
Well, basically,
you
what happened?
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, the basic story is that President Carter, before he was president, said, you know, if I get elected, I'm going to reveal all the UFO files we've got, whatever they might be. And when he came into office, he actually, you know, to his credit, you know, a lot of incoming presidents say a lot to get elected, and then when they get in power, lo and behold, it never happens. But Carter actually did stand by this promise, and, you know, he got his personnel to approach people like the FBI, the CIA, the National Security Agency, everybody else, and said, go through all your archives, find all your UFO files, and declassify them. And, you know, everybody said, yes, sir. And probably somewhere in the region of, like, 15,000 pages was actually declassified. You know, it's actually a mistake that some people think nothing surfaced. The CIA released a couple of thousand. The FBI did likewise. The Air Force released quite a bit more. And but, you know, there was no smoking gun. It was mainly lights in the sky type things, the occasional radar reports, a few pilot encounters, that sort of thing. So it was interesting from a historical value, but there wasn't anything definitive. You know, there was nothing on, like, Roswell or crash stories or abductions or anything like that. So this inevitably led to the idea that, well, you know, yes, they released something to placate everybody and have everybody think that this is all there is, but it's just the tip of the iceberg and the really good stuff being held back. And Carter himself privately even wondered that. And the story is that, you know, Carter approached George Bush Sr., who at the time was the director of the CIA. A lot of people don't know that before he became president, he was CIA director back in the 70s.
Right.
And Carter and Bush supposedly said to Carter, no, sorry, you don't have clearance. You know, this was the president. And that sounds strange, but a lot of people, again, don't realize that, you know, sometimes a president is only in power for 4 years. Maximum, they're going to be in his eight. A lot of these people in the intelligence community offices are there for decades. And, you know, if you're a president and your previous job was, say, you know, a senator or a congressman or whatever, and you've had no real exposure prior to that to the world of national security, you know, your main job has been balancing taxes in your local state or whatever, then you can understand why somebody whose background is just in, you know, keeping the local state running, so is suddenly in charge of the country. You could understand why there would be a reluctance to share with them certain data when they've had no real experience of liaising with the CIA or the NSA or understanding how official secrecy works, you know. So they have advisors who share data. And as we know, on occasion, agencies have held stuff back from the White House. You know, the White House finds out because some big newspaper blows the story, and then the White House has to scramble around to find out what on earth it's all about, because even they weren't briefed.
Yeah, and or come clean. Okay.
Yeah.
Quite a couple questions out of the chat room here now, to be fair, the phone in the chat room. Kevin wants to know, do you have an opinion as to where these aliens originate from?
Well, you know, I'm not entirely sure they're even alien in the sense of being extraterrestrial. I used to think that when I was sort of, you know, teens, 20s and whatever, and it was more sort of black and white. But, you know, I today kind of take the view that maybe we're dealing with their entities in the sense that they're alien, in that they're not from here. But I'm kind of more go down the path of like an interdimensional or extra dimensional, because in many reports, these things seem to sort of suddenly flit in and out of our reality, you know, as if they've sort of jumped from one realm to another. You know, they are totally adept at breathing our atmosphere, you know, without space helmets on or anything like that. This kind of suggests to me that maybe, you know, they're not from some faraway star system. Or some of them could be, you know, there could be several things going on. But I do wonder if they could be, you know, the simplistic approach to talk about dimensions is the idea, you know, you're driving your car, the radio's on, you don't like the channel, so you flip to another and another and another. And all these right. channels are going on at the same time, but you can only be tuned into one at any given moment. And that's the idea with this, you know, the multidimensional theory, that perhaps these things coexist with us. And maybe that explains why they're so interested in us, because unbeknownst to us, they're forced to share, you know, sort of bandwidth with us as well, if you like.
It's a lot of interesting questions there, though. I mean, you would think if it's interdimensional, there would be little or no need for some flying device. But who knows? I've got to ask this, and we're getting short on time. What is the link between the National Security Agency, mm-hmm. crop circles, and the Mayan prophecies concerning the 2012 end of the world controversy?
Yeah, this is probably one of the weirdest stories I've got in the Pyramids and Pentagon book. It basically deals with the Mayan prophecies, of course. You know, everybody knows that the Mayans, you know, had this prophecy that on December the 21st of this year, not far away now, you know, it's going to be the end of what they termed the latest in a series of Earth cycles. Now, contrary to a lot of people assume, you know, these, nowhere in the Mayan prophecies is there anything about the world ending, you know, or tsunamis or earthquakes or comets plunging into the planet. It just says it will mark the end of the next Earth cycle or the current Earth cycle, and then the one mm-hmm. after that will begin. But it's that word cycle that's got a lot of people, you know, sort of worried as to what is it going to be, a spiritual mind shift, you know, is it going to be a social upheaval? Or is it going to be, you know, a disaster, planetary disaster? We just don't know. Or is it going to be nothing? You know, we're just not sure. But the National Security Agency got involved and interested in the crop circle mystery and the Mayan mystery because over the last decade or so, more and more of the more elaborate crop circle formations, or pictograms as they're known, in the fields of England every year, more and more of them have been themed to the whole Mayan 2012 controversy. And, you know, the newspapers in Britain picked up on this deeply. You know, you'd see things like Doomsday in the crop circles, headlines like that in the national newspapers. And it actually got a lot of people worried that, you know, whatever the phenomenon behind the crop circles was, it was sort of preparing us to be ready for, you know, the 2012 disaster, whatever that might be. And the National Security Agency got actually quite concerned about the idea,
know,
that whatever,
Nick,
it was.
I'm going to have to, you know, we're going to have to bring you back because I've got another 30 questions here, but we're out of time.
Right.
Tell everybody quickly in about 20 seconds how to contact you.
People go to nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. There's a contact section, or just type my name into Facebook, Nick Redfern, and people can contact me that way. I'm always pleased to chat.
And I'll tell you, his books are worth the read. We've come to the end of another hour of Provocative Enlightenment. I want to thank you all for joining us, and I hope you enjoyed our show, and we'll join us again next week, same time and same place. And if you have comments on our show, do let us all know. Okay, until next time, wherever you are in the world, remember, believing in yourself always matters.